May it please the court. My name is Mark Dabowski. I represent Andrew Ruttenberg in this case. I think the court must have been struck after reading the briefs in this case by the three anomalies which took place in this action. The first is the anomaly of U.S. Life's own independent examiner finding Mr. Ruttenberg disabled, yet the insurance company refused to pay benefits. The second anomaly is the district court's application of policy language applicable exclusively to employees of SMW to bind a non-employee and cause a forfeiture of coverage not only to him, but which rendered illusory coverage that was afforded to 80 additional insureds under the SMW policy. And finally, the third anomaly in this case is that the court applied a law that was enacted solely to regulate benefit plans for employees and their beneficiaries to somebody who was neither. Mr. Ruttenberg was neither an employee of SMW, nor could he be legally characterized as a beneficiary of an employee benefit plan, which thereby rendered the court without subject matter jurisdiction to hear the claim under the ERISA law. I'd like to initially focus, though, on the second issue, and that's the contract language, because that was the issue on which the court determined the case. The court dealt with the provision of the policy that said that only full-time employees are eligible. The policy said the certificate of insurance defines full-time to mean active work on the participating employer's regular work schedule for the class of employees to which you belong. That provision on its face explicitly applies only to employees of SMW. SMW sets the schedule, SMW sets the class that the employee is in. Mr. Ruttenberg was neither. He was an independent trader in this case. The district court fudged the policy language in denying our request for reconsideration of the court's decision. The court referred at page 42 of the appendix to saying the policy is clear that it applies to those who worked full time, which is defined as 30 hours per week. That eliminates several key elements of the sentence in question. The policy is absolutely silent as to what the full time requirement is with respect to the independent traders who were afforded coverage under the SMW policy. At best, it would be an ambiguity with respect to the policy language, or using the analysis that Judge Lefkoe applied below, either there is a conflict in the policy or an ambiguity. And under either circumstance, provisions of contractual interpretation require that the interpretation be made in favor of the insured and in favor of insurance coverage. What we have as evidence, Your Honor, is not only the claim materials that were... Yes. The defendant's own statement of facts that they introduced at paragraph 176 of their local rule 56.1 statement described each and every duty that Mr. Ruttenberg performed. And whether or not we explicitly identified a number of hours as to each of those duties, it is pretty reasonable to conclude that Mr. Ruttenberg absolutely met the active work requirement of this policy. No. But that's really not a consideration that this court should rely upon in deciding this case, because we have a policy here which insured 80 independent traders. The court sitting here in Chicago is, I'm sure, well aware, just from watching the news, of what goes on at the Board of Trade and in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. An independent trader is somebody who trades for their own account. They're not assigned a particular time in which they trade. They can come and go as they wish. But the policy defined active work is performing each duty of your job for full pay. Mr. Ruttenberg was earning over $30,000 per month, trading commodities on a day-in and day-out basis, as any other independent commodity trader. And what we've argued, both below and to this court, is that policies have to be interpreted in their ordinary and common sense way, which is that you look at the reasonable expectations of the insured. It simply defies logic to think that a trader who goes out on the floor at the beginning of the day and either has a huge win or a huge loss at the beginning of the day is going to stay on the floor for the rest of the day. They will have earned enough to qualify as full-time employment for the day, and they would assume that if they traded on that day and every day, that they were employed full-time. And I think that the cases that we cited dealing with this full-time issue are instructive to this court as well. We have the case of the legislator in Louisiana who was receiving health insurance benefits, that's the Jetson case, was receiving health insurance benefits as a full-time employee. The legislature wasn't in session full-time. It wasn't in session every day of the year. It wasn't even in session from 9 to 5 when it was in session. Yet the court found that Representative Jetson was employed full-time because he was available full-time. We had the other case with the part-time county attorney. The court in this case put the burden on Mr. Ruttenberg rather than on the insurance company to demonstrate that he was employed 40 hours a week when, in fact, the defendant never gave us full and fair notice that they were even going to raise the issue. It's not pled as an affirmative defense. The issue first arose in legal form in response to the plaintiff's own summary judgment motion. And at that point, the record, because the court had found that the ERISA law applies, the record was closed. We couldn't even supplement the record at that point. So we were stuck with the record that we had, and under several principles of contractual interpretation and the cases that we've cited, the only reasonable conclusion is that it is simply unfair, improper, ambiguous, a violation of the reasonable expectations of the insured to find that a policy provision that applies to employees of SMW exclusively by its own language cannot be applied to Mr. Ruttenberg. So for those reasons, we believe that the court made a significant error in finding that Mr. Ruttenberg did not meet the policy eligibility requirements. But the court made another significant error even earlier than that in finding that the court had subject matter jurisdiction under the ERISA law. The ERISA law applies only if a claim can be brought by a participant in an employee benefit plan or a participant's beneficiary. Otherwise, there's no standing and there's no claim that can be brought under Section 502A1B of the ERISA law. There is no question in this case that Mr. Ruttenberg was not a participant in an employee benefit plan because the statute, 29 U.S.C. Section 1027, defines a participant as an employee of an employer. And given the Supreme Court's interpretation further in Nationwide Mutual versus Darden, there is no way that Mr. Ruttenberg could be characterized as an employee. Participant is gone. Beneficiary should also be gone, despite the spate of district court opinions in the Northern District of Illinois finding that independent commodity traders are beneficiaries. All of those decisions are in turn based on a Fifth Circuit case, Hollis versus Provident, which the Solicitor General of the United States, in arguing to the Supreme Court this past term in Yates versus Hendon, said was a decision that was in substantial tension with Nationwide Mutual versus Darden, which says that an independent contractor cannot participate in an employee benefit plan. And I realize that this perhaps creates an anomaly where the employees of SMW are subject to ERISA, while the independent contractors are not. But this court has substantial experience dealing with ERISA, and the court is well aware that there are many anomalies in the ERISA law that are completely contrary to standard contract interpretation, trust law, or common sense and logic. In fact, one judge in Alabama, Judge William Acker in Florence Nightingale versus Blue Cross, went so far as to say that he was convinced that ERISA stood for everything ridiculous imagined since Adam. And I think this court could probably reach a similar conclusion based on its own jurisprudence. The cases do not make a whole lot of sense. Correct. We filed suit and alleged jurisdiction based on diversity of citizenship. We asked for a jury trial, which we were disallowed because of ERISA, and we pled a claim under Section 155 of the Illinois Insurance Code. It is the Illinois statute relating to what would generically be known as bad faith in insurance law, and provides currently a maximum damage of $40,000 plus attorney's fees. The $40,000 would be a penalty, but no additional punitives. And that's the statutory cap, and the Illinois Supreme Court has ruled that that statute preempts any other bad faith claims. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Your Honor. I didn't hear the beginning of your... Well, first of all, when we filed this lawsuit, there were none of these district court opinions that found that these independent commodity traders were beneficiaries of ERISA plans. As far as we thought, and as far as common sense tells us, this is somebody who is insured in a group insurance policy, and the traditional remedy, if somebody is a beneficiary of a group insurance policy, is to sue in state court for breach of contract. In this case, we had complete diversity, and we had more than $75,000 in controversy. I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. No. The only provision is the provision that clearly recognizes that there are independent contractors who report their income on Form 1099, because the 1099 is the equivalent of somebody who does not have employee status.
Are there any actual employees of SMW that claim their income on 1099?
I don't see how that would be possible, because the tax law would require that they receive a W-2. I don't know for certain, Your Honor. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is a case, as the panel I'm sure has noted, that raises many issues, many of which are interesting, some of which could only be interesting to a lawyer. However, there really is no need for this court to address every one of those issues. Regardless of whether the ERISA statute applies or if this case is subject to Illinois state law, the law is the same on the analysis of whether or not a condition precedent for coverage was met by Mr. Rutenberg pursuant to the requirement that he be a full-time employee as it's defined within the policy. The Crawford case the Illinois Supreme Court came down with years ago has the same analysis as the Seventh Circuit has made in the Principal Mutual versus Charter Barkley case, that this is a condition precedent to coverage. It's not a forfeiture. It's a condition precedent to establish you are entitled to benefits, that you also establish the plaintiff's burden, that the plaintiff is a full-time employee and meets all the other requirements for coverage under the ERISA plan at issue or an insurance policy, whether it's state law or the ERISA statute. There are alternative bases for this court to have subject matter jurisdiction, obviously. If it is subject to ERISA, there's subject matter jurisdiction, but there was also subject matter jurisdiction based on diversity of citizenship. On this particular issue, it doesn't matter what the law is. There's no fact question on the issue. SMW, the employer, when it applied for the group coverage, certified to my client, U.S. Life, that, quote, all employees listed on the census are actively at work and working at least 30 hours per week, and all meet the eligibility requirements, end quote. Mr. Rutenberg is one of the employees listed on that census. He's identified as an employee, and he's identified as someone who is supposedly working at least 30 hours per week. The digest, which is another document that's given to the employer during the insurance underwriting process, specifically says that, quote, all full-time employees, paren, 30 hours per week, close paren, end quote, were eligible for coverage. The certificate of coverage that's given to Mr. Rutenberg, the document that he has that reflects and summarizes his entitlement to benefits under this plan, specifically says that, quote, the eligible classes of employees, end quote, are, quote, all full-time employees, but not those that are temporary, part-time, or seasonal, end quote. And then it defines full-time as, quote, active work on SMW's regular work schedule. The work schedule must be at least 30 hours a week, end quote. Now, Mr. Rutenberg, in another case, testified under oath that he never worked more than 3 or 4 hours a day. His claim form that he submitted in support of his disability claim to U.S. Life candidly states that he worked about 3 to 4 hours a day, 5 days a week prior to his disability. That's the evidence that was before U.S. Life. It was the evidence that was before the district court, and it's now the evidence that's before this court. Your Honor, I actually disagree with Mr. Dabosky's characterization on that. Procedurally, what occurred here on the claim was originally processed. The issue of the eligibility for coverage, the full-time employment issue, was raised and identified by U.S. Life during the claims process. Before the final claim decision was made, Mr. Rutenberg filed the lawsuit prematurely. While the case was pending before Judge Lefkow, Judge Lefkow stayed the case to allow the administrative process to continue. Documents were exchanged, correspondence was exchanged, additional medical information was submitted, and the deposition testimony of Mr. Rutenberg in that other case was submitted to the claims administrator at U.S. Life. U.S. Life denied the claim again on that appeal, and again identified the issue of full-time employment, and in fact invited Mr. Rutenberg's lawyer, Mr. Dabosky, to submit additional information on that issue if he thought it was appropriate. But specifically, U.S. Life said, you've not documented that he was working 30 hours per week as an employee. Rather than submit that additional information, and U.S. Life, by the way, in that letter, offered another level of appeal. Rather than take that other level of appeal and submit that additional information, Mr. Rutenberg elected to continue with the litigation. Now that goes to another issue that we have, and that is if ERISA applies, there's been a failure to exhaust administrative remedies here. Mr. Dabosky complained in the district court, and he's complained to this court, that there was an incomplete record before Judge Lefkow. That, you know, had we known this was an issue, we would have brought in additional evidence. Well, first of all, the issue was raised during the administrative claims process, and it was raised in the pleadings. So there's no surprise here that this was an issue in the case. Everyone knew it. In fact, the only documentation that Mr. Dabosky points to in support of his position on full-time employment is his own letter submitted during the administrative claims process, where he argues that a trader in the abstract could work, you mustn't take into account their time away from the pit in determining how hard they're working and how long they're working. And he talks about that in a hypothetical situation. It's argument by counsel, and it was something he submitted during the claims process. So there's no question that that issue was raised during the claims process and was raised in the pleadings. I would also note, just as a pleading issue, it's a condition precedent to coverage. It's not really an affirmative defense that we would need to raise. It's his burden to allege that they have met all requirements for eligibility, and under the federal rules pleading requirements, we deny that he met all the requirements for eligibility. But we did raise it in our affirmative defenses. It did. It did. Exactly. But it was also raised in that denial letter. It said, we are also raising the fact that you have failed to document that he has worked 30 hours per week, and we reserve that as an alternative basis for denial of the claim. That's in the claim denial letter that was given to Mr. Rutenberg. I actually disagree with that, Your Honor. The district court's interpretation of the policy was that Mr. Rutenberg could qualify as an employee as that term is used in the policy. But he also has to work 30 hours per week. And there is no evidence that a Board of Trade trader or anyone who works at the Board of Trade is incapable of working full time. To the contrary, Mr. Dabosky, the counsel for Mr. Rutenberg through his counsel, argued that you need to take into account the totality of the work they do preparing for the day's trades. It's just like a lawyer who tries cases. Just because they may be in, the trial only occurs for 3 hours, you got to take into account the time they prepare for trial and preparing for the trades and dealing with customers and dealing with documentation and paperwork. Mr. Rutenberg was obviously a successful trader. He generated $30,000 a month in income. And Mr. Dabosky may be correct that because of that success, he could go take his winnings each day and go home and call it a day and do whatever he's going to do, go out on the golf course or whatever. But he wasn't working full time. And it's not an unusual requirement in this type of disability insurance policy, whether it's subject to ERISA or state law, that that be a requirement. I think it's important for the court to keep in mind that there's no medical underwriting that occurs in a group insurance context. But there is a requirement that all the participants or beneficiaries of that particular plan be full-time employees. And that is how an insurance company avoids adverse selection. You get someone who only works part-time, it may be because of a medical reason. And they may have already teed it up for a disability claim. But if they're working full-time up until the date where the coverage becomes effective and up until the date before they post-inception claim disability, the insurance company, from an underwriting standpoint, has some comfort that it's issuing coverage to a good risk. And by doing that, it lowers the cost of insurance for all the other participants in that pool of insurance. So it's a valid and significant requirement and not unusual at all in the disability insurance context that you require that these participants be full-time employees. Well, even, Your Honor, I don't see, I cannot fathom why the requirement would be any different for an independent contractor, particularly when I say that the policy, the general policy reasons behind this requirement are consistent with good insurance underwriting and spreading the risk among a pool of possible insureds. You requiring an independent contractor to be a full-time employee, there would be no inconsistency or ambiguity in that. And that's what Judge Lefkow found. Like, regardless of whether he's an employee, there's no question he wasn't working full-time. And if he's not working full-time, he cannot be covered under this particular policy. Now, that's right, but that very same language, Your Honor, also says that the only people who are eligible are employees. So, now Judge Lefkow said, I disagree with Judge Lefkow's analysis that there is an ambiguity in that phrase. She relied on the fact that the policy also defines employees who receive a 1099. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're no longer employees or create an ambiguity. Judge Lefkow's analysis on that issue, I think, was also flawed in that she found there was an ambiguity in that and immediately construed it against the insurance company. And the Seventh Circuit law on that issue, and Illinois state law, is that contra pro parentum, that rule of contract construction, is a rule of last resort. And it's only if all other rules of contract construction cannot resolve the ambiguity. It is, Your Honor. I would refer, Your Honor, to the Seventh Circuit's opinion in Bach versus Platinum Technology, where the court, it was an ERISA case, but the court in that case analyzed general rules of contract construction in an insurance context and found that the ambiguity issue was one that where you need to, it's a rule of construction of last resort. If ERISA does apply this case, by the way, and it's our position that an arbitrary and capricious standard of review should apply, U.S. Life was vested with the discretion to construe the terms of the policy as well, and the Seventh Circuit precedent on that issue is that if that deferential standard is applicable, that rule of contra pro parentum no longer applies.
Contract,
Your Honor, I would, in an ERISA context, if I would agree with you if there is no discretionary authority vested with the insurance company, and if there is no other way to resolve the ambiguity. Again, that rule of contract construction is a rule of last resort. But in an ERISA context, it's not applicable at all. In this instance, there was language. I'm sorry, Your Honor? Basic law that if there's an ambiguity, the insurance company always loses? Yes, sir. Your Honor, I would agree that that is a rule of contract construction that is in existence. But I would also say that it is a rule of contract construction that is a rule of last resort. If there is no other reasonable basis to resolve the ambiguity, then you apply that sort of robotic, automatic formula that you rule against the drafter. In an ERISA context, though, this particular plan vested U.S. Life with discretionary authority. The contract between the employer and U.S. Life has specific language that is squarely within the safe harbor that this court enunciated. It did not, Your Honor. The summary plan description did not say that. And there is the case law that's out there says that the summary plan description could be silent on that issue. If the plan document vests discretion, and it's a plan document that would control. Now, Mr. Of course, Your Honor. And there is no evidence here that there was any lack of notice given to Mr. Rutenberg on that issue. It's our position that on its face, that's a plan document. Judge Lefkow said that's not really a plan document. But you really give an analysis of that. If it's not a plan document, what is it? It's a contract between the insurance company and the employer, where the employer, which establishes and maintains the plan and is a plan fiduciary, specifically agrees that U.S. Life shall have the discretion to determine eligibility and to construe the terms of the plan. And if Mr. Rutenberg had requested the plan documents, the employer as the plan administrator would have been under a duty to provide that document to him.
I'd like to return to your comments a few moments ago. I understand you to say that taking the part-time, full-time issue aside for a moment, you do believe that the plaintiff does fall within the definition of employee.
I actually do not. I believe that if he is taking the position that he is an independent contractor, and if that's the case, then he shouldn't be eligible for this coverage at all. Correct, John. And that's consistent with this court's finding in Principal Mutual versus Charter Barkley. The term employee, when it is an eligibility requirement, and in the policy it says we cover eligible employees, or employees are eligible for coverage, you must apply the plain ordinary meaning of that term, and the plain ordinary meaning of that term would not include independent contractors. Now, the fact that he gets a 1099 form doesn't necessarily mean he's not an employee. And there, in Nationwide versus Darden, the court enunciated the dozen elements you look at, only one of which is tax treatment. That doesn't end the inquiry. He's, though, conceded he's an independent contractor. It's his position he's not an employee. And I believe that takes care of that issue as well. Judge Lefkow said there's an ambiguity on it. But in any event, you don't even need to deal with that issue because there's no question he didn't work 30 hours a week. I do want to touch on just a couple of the other issues before my time is up, unless Your Honor has a question. I touched on the exhaustion requirement, and it's significant here because it does address Mr. Zabofsky's position, which is inconsistent, that there was a truncated record, but it's truncated because he cut off the administrative process. And the failure to exhaust administrative remedies should have been an alternative basis for summary judgment in this case. He filed the case before there was a final decision on the original claim. Then, after it was raised that there's an appeal and we need to complete that process, it was remanded for the appeal. And then the decision was made on appeal, and he was offered another level of appeal with a different claims adjuster. And he passed on that. The deadline passed that was given, I think it was 60 days, to file another appeal. And he decided to proceed with the litigation in the federal court. At that time, if my recollection is correct, the court had not yet decided the issue of whether or not this was going to be subject to state law or federal law. Perhaps his position was, if it's subject to state law, I don't need to exhaust. And that may have been a risk they were willing to take. but we believe it's subject to ERISA.
Has the question of ERISA preemption been raised by that point?
It had been raised in a motion to dismiss, which had not yet been ruled upon, is if my memory serves me correctly, Your Honor. On the merits, Judge Sykes, which we, you know, I finally get to at the end, if I can just speak, if I can have just a minute longer just to touch on those. Oh, thank you, Your Honor. My mistake. If the arbitrary and capricious standard applies, and we believe it does, there's no question that this is a reasonable denial of the claim, because there are, at a minimum, conflicting medical evidence before the plan administrator, and the plan administrator is vested with the discretion to make the call over which of those pieces of evidence it will rely upon. And then lastly, regardless of that, regardless of whether it's a de novo or an arbitrary capricious standard of review, there's no question that Mr. Rutenberg was never under the regular care of a physician. In fact, he saw a physician maybe six times over the 3 or 4 year period that's in question here, and never received any treatment at all for what is ultimately the basis for his claim, this vocal cord dysfunction syndrome. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. I guess where I want to start is with respect to my client's name. It's pronounced Rutenberg. Both he and his mother are in the courtroom. I think it's only appropriate to pronounce his name correctly during the course of the argument. With respect to what took place in this case, I think that one of the questions posed by the panel really sort of put the thumb on top of the issue. And what I'd like to cite to illustrate what took place here is this court's recent decision in Dabberton versus HCR Manor Care, where the court said an ERISA benefit cannot be a moving target where the plan administrator continues to add conditions precedent to the award of benefits. When Mr. Rutenberg originally applied for benefits, there was not a word about ERISA applying to this case, nor was there any issue raised whatsoever with respect to his eligibility. The only issue that was raised in the initial claim determination, and shortly before the initial suit was filed, it was communicated that the decision was going to be upheld, was that the insurance company had determined that Mr. Rutenberg was not medically qualified to receive the benefits. Then we got into the litigation, and then there was a motion to dismiss filed on grounds of ERISA. By that point, after the complaint was filed, no issue raised whatsoever with respect to his eligibility. The motion to dismiss initially only dealt with whether the claim was preempted by ERISA. The court found that we didn't properly plead diversity of citizenship and dismissed the case on an independent basis. We filed a new complaint, then the ERISA issue came up. The court found that the claim was preempted by ERISA, then we filed an amended complaint alleging an ERISA cause of action, and then at that point the defendant filed an answer. The answer made no reference whatsoever to these eligibility issues. While the denial letter that preceded the resumption of the litigation said that was something that they were considering as a possible issue, for all we knew, because it wasn't signaled in the pleading as an affirmative defense should be, the defendant had decided that was not going to be an issue on which they could succeed. And then it was only actually brought before the court after the plaintiff had filed for summary judgment.
Isn't the case that you filed this lawsuit before receiving an affirmative denial of the claim?
Initially, that's correct, because we were operating under the assumption that the claim was governed by state law, and under state law, there's no doctrine of exhaustion of remedies. But as the court found in the summary judgment ruling, the exhaustion of remedies issue is really a red herring, because by calling a halt to the litigation, agreeing to another round of review, then we had fully satisfied any exhaustion requirement. And what defendant failed to mention is that the determination on whether the exhaustion doctrine should be applied is committed to the discretion of the district judge. And there has been no claim whatsoever that the district judge abused her discretion in finding that there was no exhaustion issue in this case. I just need to say a word about discretionary authority. Then I won't say that word. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both Mr. Dubofsky and Mr. McMahon for their fine presentations today and their fine briefs. case will be taken under advisement.